Introduce yourself, please.
I'm Kansas State Representative John Rubin. I have the privilege of representing the 18th District, which is the east half of the city of Shawnee, and I've been in the legislature since 2011.
Outstanding. Here comes the open. This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff. We're using coffee and donuts to help us better understand the historic legislative session underway in Topeka. The issues and the people in the Kansas legislature. Here we go. Joining John and myself this morning in the KCUR production studio is Sarah Prem from Overland Park. Sarah, welcome to you. And my KCUR colleague Peggy Lowe from our Harvest Unit, and I believe our second Pulitzer Prize winner here on State House Blend. Peggy, thanks for being
here. That's absolutely right. Thanks.
Before we go around the table, John, I start with my two favorite questions, and that is tell me about your kids and your pets and how you ended up in the Kansas State House.
We have two grown daughters, of which we are very proud. The only problem is neither of them live in the Kansas City area.
Where do they live? Moved
on, well, our oldest, with her husband and our three grandchildren, live in Denver, which is great, except unfortunately she has become a Denver Broncos fan, and I don't know where we went wrong there. And our youngest daughter, unmarried, lives in Atlanta, where I served for a number of years as FDIC Regional Counsel. That's where she grew up, and so she has gravitated back to Atlanta.
The you had a long, interesting career in the military and in law, always somehow in laws. But how'd you find yourself running for the Kansas State House and being elected to office?
Well, I like to say that I've always been interested and had a desire to be able to fashion public policy that, in my view, is in the best interest of the citizens of my state, Kansas. I was born and raised in Overland Park. Born in 1948, so go back quite a ways there. And I majored in political science in college, up at Boston College. But I kind of got sidetracked with about a 35-year legal career. But when I retired, last 10 years I was in a federal administrative law judge. And when I retired from the bench in 2004, I found both the opportunity the interest in running for office for the first time. Of course, all the time I was a federal employee, I was precluded from doing that. And in order, again, to have an impact on public policy for the good of our state. So that's what got me interested. I ran for the first time in 2008, lost, but came back, ran in 2010, and have been elected and reelected since.
Yeah, I want to come back to some of your administrative law judge and legal experience later. But first, let's go around the table. Sarah, what's on your mind? What does Representative Rubin need to know as we're wrapping up the legislative – oh, maybe wrapping up the legislative session. Who really knows? What's on your mind?
Well, I do work for a firm that does infrastructure here in town, and so I am very interested in – how we will continue to fund roads, bridges. We obviously have a lot of problems in that area, certainly across the country. So we'd like to see how we can continue to update that. Infrastructure is very important to our economy. It creates jobs. You know, there's a lot of important things there. I think the budget, certainly you mentioned that earlier, Sam, that how are we going to pay for the things that our citizens need?
Let's start with we'll get to the budget. Let's start with infrastructure. It's pretty interesting. It's a topic that we have not talked about on the podcast yet. To help balance the budget, the legislature's reached in. They have for some time into the Highway Trust Fund, took out $100-some million. So are we going to be able to keep the keep those Kansas roads and bridges as nice as they've been historically?
Well, KDOT continues to tell us that so far – The money that has we refer to Kansas Department of Transportation as the Bank of KDOT. I have not supported in the past and don't support this year continuing to raid the transportation fund. Those funds that are dedicated as part of the state sales tax that are supposed to go for infrastructure, roads, highways, maintenance, construction and maintenance. We should not be raiding those funds. We have in the past to balance the budget. I suspect some of that's going to happen again this year. I don't support that. That's a Band-Aid. It's a short-term fix, number one. So far, however, I will say that KDOT is reporting that no existing project that's on the books or underway in terms of construction and maintenance will be jeopardized with the funds that have been taken so far from KDOT. But if that continues, certainly it will have an adverse impact. And in any event, that's not the way to balance the budget, in my view.
Yeah, let me just follow up with that very quickly. Not rating the Bank of KDOT puts you at odds with the Republican leadership. How are you expressing yourself? Are you being heard by the leadership in this regard?
Somewhat. Not as thoroughly as I would like. I serve on neither the Appropriations Committee nor the Tax Committee in the House. I'm, because of my legal background and the areas in which I've worked, before I was an administrative law judge for a number of years, I worked for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. So I am chairman of the House Corrections and Juvenile Justice Committee. So I don't get the level of input that somebody who actually serves on appropriations, for example, or on the tax committee would get in these areas. I make my views known. I've made it very clear to leadership since I've been there that I think that we have not been responsible in our in spending restraint over the last 4 years. And I don't subscribe to across-the-board spending cuts either. They have to be tailored and measured. There are areas where we can achieve savings, areas where we can't. I happen to think the Department of Corrections is an area where no further cuts should be made absolutely. We are at 101% of capacity in our state prisons. And matter of fact, I've pursued a number of measures to try to ease the prison overcrowding situation. But what I think we haven't sufficiently explored are targeted spending cuts at the same time that we reduce taxes. And also, there are an awful lot of funds out there called unencumbered funds. School districts have them. The regions have them and others. This is money we've already appropriated that are kept in what can generally be called reserve or rainy day funds. Some of that needs to be kept in reserve, but those figures now statewide are over $2 billion. That's with a B. And I think that we can tap some of those funds not to bring back to the state general fund, but rather to have the entities involved, whether it's a school district, whether it's the Board of Regents, spend to satisfy their needs before we talk about tax increases.
Peggy Lowe, I know that look on your face. You've got something to say.
So, John, you don't support Governor Brownback's grand experiment to, you know, level the playing field here allegedly on income taxes and change the budget so dramatically?
Actually, I do support not only reductions but elimination of the state income tax. But in my view, it has not been done the right way. You cannot really do it piecemeal. I happen to be a fair tax supporter, and I think—
Explain what that means.
Okay. A fair tax is it's not a flat tax. It's something different than that. It is also not a value-added tax. I want to make those two things perfectly clear. But what it is a consumption tax, and I've had a proposal that I've sponsored the last 3 years in the legislature that we haven't been able to move to replace the current state income tax, the current state sales tax, and the current state, not local, but state property tax with a fair tax. Now, the fair tax, very briefly, how the fair tax works is it is revenue neutral, so we'll be sure that we can continue to generate the amount of revenue we need to fund essential state services, schools, and all of our other essential state functions. A figure will be arrived at, and that figure is in somewhat of a state of flux, but it would be somewhere around 16% or 17%. Of all goods and services purchased in the state of Kansas, not value added, just at the point of retail sale of the goods or the services, to protect lower income individuals, the fair tax is accompanied by a prebate, and it gets a little complicated in terms of calculations. But basically, based on federal numbers, we can calculate the average amount of expenditures for goods and services of individuals, and you pick a poverty level, probably about 150% of the poverty level. And what you do is you exempt that amount from tax. And the way you exempt it is you calculate the tax on that amount of purchases, and you refund that with a prebate check to every Kansas citizen. And then folks can, go ahead and spend for their needs and for their wants with goods and services throughout the year, and they will pay the tax, but they will have had that prebate. So that eliminates any adverse effects on lower-income individuals. That's a fair tax. It would replace all taxes. So in my view, rather than doing this piecemeal, we should have marched to zero within the next couple of years with maybe one or two transition years to get rid of the income tax altogether. Allow me to say one other thing. The other problem with the income tax, separate and apart from revenue questions, is it puts government in the business of picking winners and losers. There are an awful lot as long as we are living with the income tax, I would like to see a lot of loopholes closed that give exemptions and credits to businesses, particularly large businesses in the state of Kansas, that can afford the lawyers and the lobbyists to get tax breaks for themselves at the expense of the average taxpaying individual. That's one of the main things I don't like about an income tax. And I would like to see a lot of those loopholes closed. I've said to the governor on more than one, to his office on more than one occasion, if we're serious about eliminating the income tax, then why are we hanging on to exemptions, deductions, and credits for businesses? Because once you eliminate the income tax, then that becomes immaterial. So let's.
What was his response to that, John, when you said that to Brownback?
Thank you very much for your comments.
That's it. Yeah.
Well, that seems to be, if I may, that seems to be the regular response from the governor's administration. Thanks for letting us know, and then off on the road that they're going on. Would you agree with that, John?
Yes, the governor continues. I mean, he has his proposals. They include a number of tax initiatives this year that I absolutely do not support, raising the gasoline tax, raising tax on tobacco and alcohol, for the first time imposing a state income tax on utility bills. I don't support any of those because they are going to hit hardest the people that can least afford to pay, number one, and they're anti-competitive in a border county like Johnson County. We've got enough folks going over to Missouri now to buy their gasoline and and their cigarettes and their alcohol and groceries, where the tax is quite a bit cheaper in Missouri. And if we raise these taxes, you're going to have even more people going over to Missouri. So you're not going to realize anywhere near the increase in sales tax that you think you're going to get from these things, because more people are going to avoid them, at least in Johnson County, by going to Missouri. And it hurts small businesses in Kansas. That's why I don't support them.
Sarah, I was watching you while John was explaining the fair tax, and I can't tell whether you were dubious or confused. So which one is it? Or maybe it's somewhere in between. I don't know.
It was surprised.
And by the way, while you're talking about that, I was wondering, John, if you could pour me just a little bit more coffee.
I'd be happy to.
Appreciate it. Yeah. Anyway, Sarah, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It was surprise, actually.
Surprise? I mean, does it sound something – does it sound interesting to you?
Does it sound scary? I'm actually kind of been a closet fan of a flat tax. So I'm kind of interested in learning more about this fair tax concept and – how that would roll out and how that would be implemented.
It kind of sounds like a logistical nightmare, if I just might add. It does sound fascinating.
It does sound a little regressive,
you know, it's like you raise the sales tax, but you still try to protect the poor. So that's all cool. But does the Department of Revenue say, no way? I mean, it just sounds like the whole idea of the prebate and all that. It sounds very complicated.
It is logistically difficult. The Department of Revenue has not been a big fan. Well, first of all, they represent the administration, so they speak the governor's language. They support the governor's programs. Beyond that, there's no question the transition will not be easy. And, you know, I support the fair tax nationally, and the same would be true there as well. So for a couple of years, it will be difficult. But once we get it rolled out, I think it is the fairest way to tax Kansas citizens and raise the revenue we need. No doubt about it, though, it is going to be difficult in the short run, and particularly with regard to those prebates, as you said. We're going to have to identify addresses, where to send the checks, that sort of thing. But you have to do that now with income tax refunds anyway. So that's what I've said to the Department of Revenue. I mean, you should have the systems in place and the procedures in place already, because the same folks that file income tax returns would be eligible. And I know a number of folks don't have to file income tax returns. But the point there would be the individual, if they want the prebate, would provide the information to the Department of Revenue so we'd know where to send the prebate check. But no question, the devil's always in the details on these things, and there is a lot of work yet to be done to refine the transition period.
Do you have any support for this?
Yes. I had 2 years ago when I introduced it was as an individually sponsored bill. So in that case, you can solicit other members of your body to co-sponsor, and I had 32 co-sponsors in the House of Representatives for it. Of course, it takes 63 votes, generally speaking, to get something passed in the House, so I was halfway there just with sponsors. So that was quite a bit of support, and we didn't get it out of tax committee, however, last year, because the governor's office and leadership are not fans, frankly, of this particular proposal, partly because of the logistics involved. Last year, it was introduced as a committee bill rather than an individual. I still drafted it and sponsored it, but I introduced it through the tax committee, so it was a tax committee bill. But I think we're still short of the 63 that it would take The Speaker quite often says, we'll work anything in committee and on the House floor if you bring me 63, if you can show me you got 63 votes for it. We're working on it. We're getting there. We're not there yet.
John, Sarah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, and what has been the business community's response to this?
Some very positive, some not so much. Obviously, service industries, service businesses that currently are not subject to sales tax, particularly in Johnson County, which is a service-based economy, are not happy that we'll start charging tax on services. But it is not economically feasible otherwise. You can't support the fair tax otherwise. So there is some concern there. But statistics, and Dr. R. Hall, who's a professor of economics out at KU, has provided a lot of the information that I've studied and is a strong advocate of the fair tax, and he talks about it quite a bit. Again, during the transition period, there might be some difficulty. I will be quite frank. There will probably be some people that will live in Kansas that will go over to Missouri for their services, and we're talking about everything from doctors and lawyers to your haircuts, might go over to Missouri for a while, so that will be a net drain in the short term. But we think that as we develop the idea, and as more and more people from outside Kansas recognize that without an income tax, it is so much more economically advantageous to live in Kansas, that'll bring in a lot more population, and with it, the economic activity that I think will be the real spur for growth in the state of Kansas. We have been not only economically stagnant for the most part over the last 10 to 20 years in Kansas, but we've been stagnant in terms of population growth. We had a net out-migration for a number of years during the Sebelius administration. We've turned that around a little bit, but we're not gaining a lot of population. We're still under or around 2.9 million people, and that's stayed pretty constant, 2.8, 2.9 million for the last 15 years at least. So this is a policy that I think also will attract a lot more in-migration to the state of Kansas.
I want to talk a little bit about the budget, and we don't talk much about labels here on State House Blend. But I have to say that we haven't had too many conservative Republicans come in and sit in this seat, and so it's good to have that voice here. And I say that because we've had a number of moderates come in and Democrats come in and talk about how they've been cut out of the budget process. How the Senate and where we are now is that the Senate has passed a budget. They've essentially are trying to just meld that in into a shell of a bill on the House. There's been no committee work on it. And if that happens, then no amendments from the House floor. Any guy who talks about a fair tax, and anybody who sat on the bench as long as you, must have a deep sense of fairness. So what do you think about that? It feels like that some in your own party and certainly the minority party has been cut out on this. What are your thoughts on that, John?
I absolutely agree with them. I don't like the process at all. One of my other principal points of focus since I've been in the legislature is public accountability and transparency. And there's been a number of things I've pursued along those lines. But one of those is that whether we're talking about the budget or anything else, but particularly about the budget, which constitutionally is the one bill we do have to pass every
year. That's the only thing you have to do.
Right. Public accountability requires that all 125 members of the House have a chance to have an input on that budget. Not just the 25 that sit on the Appropriations Committee, and certainly not just the three, which would be the chair, the vice chair, and the ranking minority member of the Conference Committee from Appropriations, but all 125 members should have a chance. I've got some amendments I'd like to propose for areas where I think we can reasonably cut some spending in the budget. For example, and yet what has happened this year is we never got the House budget out to the floor for a full debate and an up or down vote. Never did. And that means I didn't get to, so far I haven't had a chance to even speak for or against the budget or any aspect of the budget, nor have I had an opportunity to bring the amendments that I have in mind. And the same is true of every other representative that isn't on the Appropriations Committee. The procedure that leadership in the House and the Senate are using this year is the Senate has passed a budget and they sent it straight to conference committee, and therefore there are exactly six out of 165 members of the legislature, House and Senate, there are exactly six that are getting any input into fashioning that budget now, and that is or that are the those are the three senators and the three representatives that are the conference committee on the budget. It's going to come out to the floor probably next week, and I've seen enough of it already to know I'm not entirely satisfied with it, and I suspect a lot of my moderate and liberal colleagues, Democrat or Republican, are not satisfied with it either. But when it comes out in a conference committee report, you can't amend it. You can talk for or against it, speak for or against it, but you can't amend it, and it comes out as a fait accompli. And I'm not going to vote as a fait accompli on any budget that has cooked into it, built into it, the need to raise taxes by as much as $400 million or more, which is what I think this budget is going to provide. I cannot in good conscience vote for that because I'm not going to vote for $400 million in tax increases, even including closing loopholes and eliminating exemptions. That's no way to do the budget. That's no way to do public policy, and I don't like it.
And I want to go around the horn one more time, but just before we get to Sarah and Peggy, so as the budget stands right now, you're a no vote.
I'm a no vote on the budget as it stands right now. That's correct. Mm-hmm. And don't appreciate the fact that I don't get a chance to have my input into it as well.
Well, I think that kind of speaks to what I've been thinking about. It's our political process has gotten so contentious and so uncooperative and uncollaborative. What can a citizen do? It becomes quite overwhelming to look at this debate that's going on, and apparently not publicly. These things are happening behind the scenes. What can a citizen do?
It's even though it sounds trite, it is true that every citizen, every voter should contact their state senator and representative and let them know that you object to this way of doing business, that you want your senator and representative to have a say in the budget. And believe it or not, legislators do listen to what they hear from their constituents in particular by email or by telephone. And if enough people call in and talk to enough folks, it might make a difference. I would recommend that everybody contact leadership. The Senate President is Susan Weigel. The Senate Majority Leader is Terry Bruce. Senate Vice President is Senator Jeff King. House Speaker Ray Merrick. House Speaker Pro Tem Peggy Mast. Contact those folks and say you object to any procedure where you're assuming that your senator and representative are not part of that conference committee. Assuming that is the case, the chair, by the way, of the House Appropriations Committee, who's the chair of the conference committee for the House, is Ron Reichman, Jr. of Olathe, by the way. But assuming that your representative or senator are not one of those three, say you don't appreciate the fact that your senator and representative are not getting a fair say on the budget.
And by the way, when you send those emails, I want you to say John Rubin sent me. Peggy, go ahead.
But I was going to say, don't have people send 1,000 of them at one time like Uber did.
I have to say, I love both of Sarah's questions because, you know, the elephant in the room here in Kansas is this idea that this draconian budget, which has not been proven to work, has been shoved down the throats, not just of the people, but of even, you know, members of Brownback's own party like you. And so I'm sure you probably hear about this a lot. But when you see headlines in the Star, for instance, this week that says schools are going to close early because we don't have money, highways are going unfixed, and things just seem to be crumbling down, and yet they turn a blind eye towards their own party, to people. It just feels rather hopeless, and it's made Kansas a laughing stock nationally. Does that concern you guys up in Topeka?
Well, certainly it concerns us. I will say, again, I'm going to repeat with KDOT, the Secretary of the Kansas Department of Transportation has assured us that so far, based on the amount of money taken back from the T-Works, the transportation fund, it has not jeopardized any existing contract. Either in process or on the books for construction or road maintenance. So far, it hasn't harmed the T-Works program. It's not to say that harm wouldn't occur if this rating continues.
What about with those regard, schools?
With regard to schools, I strongly supported the bill that replaced the broken school finance formula with the block grant program, because all the school finance formula did was solidify in statute unfairness between the districts and constantly got us sued. And we can all agree on one thing: the money we spent litigating in court is not money that gets to the classroom. And I could give you other reasons for it. And remember, some school districts were very much in favor of that bill. The both the superintendent of the Shawnee Mission School District and of the Blue Valley School District supported the block grant bill this year.
But other districts, honestly, John, they were outliers, and you know that.
Well, yeah, I mean, it all depends. You know, where you sit is where you stand. Some districts were benefited by the bill, and that includes Shawnee Mission,
right,
which is my district, and some districts in some poorer districts were not.
Well, Dale,
and that's the reason for the concern.
Yeah. Dale Dennis, who
but
is,
we need a long term fix to the school finance problem, and yeah. and the old formula was not the right fix.
Yeah, I just need to follow up on that. Dale Dennis from the Kansas Department of Education. Arguably the guy who knows most about school funding in Kansas, testified in court on Friday that there was a total of $54 million. The block grant has cost Kansas school districts a total of $54 million, and every school district in Kansas will be getting less operating money because of block grants. He testified to that in open court. Do you still support the block grants and think that that's the best way to go?
I do. I didn't hear his testimony, and I'm certainly not doubting your recounting of it. But he may be mistaken, because some school districts are getting increased funding. The Shawnee Mission School District's one of them. More fundamentally than that, let me say a couple of things about school finance. We are currently based.
This is my day job, by the way, covering education.
Right.
All right. Okay.
We are currently the fourth highest state in the nation in terms of the percent of our budget that we spend on K through 12 education. It's about 50, as you know, it's about 51-52% of our budget. Our surrounding states are all in the 35-37% range. That's the national average. We spend more as a percent of our budget on K through 12 education than almost any state in the union. Our per pupil spending, and yes, it does include CAPERS, but our per pupil spending is at an all-time high. There's only been one year where there's been an actual reduction in per pupil spending since I've been around the legislature, and that was actually the last year of the Parkinson administration, the last year of Governor Parkinson's term. It was the year before I came. It was the only year that per pupil spending actually went down. For those who say you shouldn't be counting CAPERS in the per pupil numbers, I would ask you to point to any private industry where they don't include health care and retirement costs for their employees as part of the cost of doing business. So I would argue that should be the case. Beyond that, my understanding, and I also do not sit on the Education Committee. Again, my bailiwick is the Judiciary Committee and Corrections and Criminal Justice in the state of Kansas, which I would love to talk to you at length about, because I have a number of ideas for savings, because we've got to reduce the number of people we're incarcerating in Kansas. That's another discussion. But a lot of what I've done this year has been designed to reduce bed space impact, to free up more beds for the violent criminals we need to have them for. So anyway, there are savings that could be. I carried a bill this week. Let me stay with education, but I would like to make one point on that if we have time.
Sure.
At the end. But with regard to education, my understanding was overall spending for schools increased. I thought the figure I heard was about $54 million. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I voted for it. Overall spending on schools. Now, are some school districts hurt by it? Are they getting less? Yes, absolutely. That is true. It would be incorrect if anybody says that every school district benefits from the block grant program. I think that would be an incorrect statement, and that's why some are unhappy and some are closing their doors early. But that gets back to the point I made about unencumbered funds. My understanding is the amount of and let me clarify in this regard. The Shawnee Mission School District, which is the one that's my school district, the one with which I'm most familiar, is not a culprit in this area, but I will use that word advisedly, because there are some school districts that have saved, I would use the term squirreled away in some circumstances, money that we've already taken from the taxpayers and appropriated to them, and statewide that amounts to over $1.2 billion. That are in unencumbered funds by the school district. And unencumbered means they are not committed for any current operating expenses or capital improvements or anything of that sort. They are strictly reserves, rainy day funds, whatever term you want to use. And there's no question they all need some amount of rainy day funds, but not $1.2 billion. So for school districts that say they have to close their doors early or they have to lay off teachers, my first question to them would be, what is the size of your unencumbered fund in your school district? And when is the last time you tapped any part of that fund, money we've already appropriated to go to the classroom, when is the last time you spent any amount of that fund to keep your doors open and not lay off teachers? That would be my first question to any of those districts.
Mm-hmm. One quick point about corrections you wanted to make.
Yeah. you may have heard just Thursday, as a matter of fact, I had the privilege of carrying a bill out of our corrections committee that I think is smart public policy that will both reduce prison bed space impact and take a more realistic approach in the area of marijuana possession. I sponsored and carried a bill that lowered the penalties for first and second time marijuana possession in the state of Kansas. First time marijuana possession convictions right now are Class A misdemeanors. Second time on, it's a felony. And if you have a prior criminal history of other offenses, it could get you up to 42 months in prison for a second time. And I'm talking about simple possession. I'm not talking about large amounts where you could be construed to be a distributor. I'm talking about small amounts of marijuana. So I supported a bill. It came out of the Kansas Sentencing Commission, which I serve on, to reduce the penalty for first-time marijuana possession to a Class B misdemeanor, which is essentially a fine. Second-time possession, a Class A misdemeanor, which could also net you a few days in county jail, but no more than that. And only third time on will it become a felony. And there's a twofold reason for that. One is to relieve pressures on prison bed space because occasional marijuana users that are not habitual criminals can, first of all, they can be better served in the community. That's the other side of the argument. They can, if they're really interested in getting drug treatment, they can get it better in the community. Even if they're not, to me, they should not have a criminal history that's going to haunt them for the rest of their life of a felony for a first or second time marijuana possession. And at the same time, as I say, it'll relieve prison bed space. So those beds are available for dangerous felons, violent felons, not for people that are possessing small amounts of marijuana.
John, you're going to get yourself kicked out of this party. I'm just telling you, you're not supporting the budget. You're going to soften marijuana laws.
Yeah.
You may not be much longer for this world.
Yeah. Well, and on that, thank you. And in addition to that, and I always try to pursue what I think is correct public policy. In addition to that, an amendment to that bill was brought on the floor by a Democrat, John Wilson, of I believe he's from Lawrence, but anyway. That's basically a medical marijuana provision,
right.
Hemp oil,
right.
For certain, tightly regulated by the Kansas Department of Health and Environment, to make that available for certain disorders, primarily children with seizure disorder, mm-hmm. and the like, where it has been demonstrated that that can have an ameliorative effect. That amendment was added on. Now, I actually opposed the amendment on the floor, not because I don't support the concept, but because it hadn't been fully vetted. I hadn't heard it in my committee, and I want to make sure that proper safeguards are in place. I also want to see what the feds think about it, because the first thing the feds did to Colorado after they legalized marijuana, which I don't support, but after they legalized marijuana, the feds said, well, I don't care what you did. It's still a Schedule I narcotic under the federal drug laws, and we're going to continue to enforce it. And actually, a lawsuit's now been filed against Colorado. I don't want that to happen to Kansas. So I'd like to study it more. I'm long-term a supporter of medical marijuana tightly controlled in the state of Kansas, but I didn't think Thursday was the right time. But regardless of what I thought, the amendment passed and was added to the bill, got 86 votes, and so it is now part of the bill as it goes over to the Senate for consideration.
I want to – we do need to leave it here pretty quickly, but I do want to follow up on that. Has your thinking on weed changed over the years? So have you gone from not supporting medical marijuana to now supporting medical marijuana, and do you see yourself ever saying yes to legalizing weed?
Certainly good questions once again. I've always thought, for many years, I have thought that we over-criminalize, particularly possession of marijuana. I'm a strong
yes.
believer that if you try something for 40 or 50 years and it doesn't work well, maybe you ought to try something else. And our war on drugs has certainly fits that category. That's why I supported President Obama's normalizing of relations with Cuba, by the way. And totally separate subject, but same
principle. I really don't know how that ended up in Topeka, but
I just weigh in on everything. But it's the same principle. When you try something for 40 or 50 years and it doesn't work, it's time to try something else. I've always thought it's been over-criminalized. On the other hand, I do still think there are demonstrated harmful effects to recreational marijuana use that, to me, to this day, continue to put me in the camp of not completely legalizing it. Should I think it should be decriminalized, which is a separate issue? That means treated more like what the Wichita Ballot Initiative proposed, treat it as an infraction, like a traffic infraction with a fine, as long as there's not a prior criminal history of more serious offenses or any attempt to distribute, and at small amounts, I would seriously consider that. And I have, yes, I have evolved on my views on medical marijuana as I've studied and read more about the issue and seen its ameliorative effects. I have changed my mind about that, and that's why I think properly structured, I will support the medical marijuana provision, but I don't think this bill is the right time for it.
Outstanding discussion today. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. Lots of ways to listen. You can subscribe to us on iTunes. Find us at KCUR.org/StatehouseBlend. And our friends over there on UpToDate clear out some space for us on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Want to be in Sarah's seat for a future Statehouse Blend? You can email me at KCUR.org. Are you on the Twitter? Do you enjoy the Twitter? I bet you are. You can follow
Love
me. I'm at Sam Zeff. John Rubin, to get to know you just a little bit better, we end the program with your favorite song. What is it?
Oh, well, if I had to pick one, I've got a lot, but if I had to pick one, it'd be the greatest piece of music, in my view, of the last 100-plus years, and that's Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin.
I couldn't agree with you more. I'm Sam Zeff. We'll see you next time on Statehouse Blend.